Welcome to the CoinGecko podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Young. Each week, we'll be interviewing someone from the blockchain industry to learn more about this fast-moving cryptocurrency economy. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. The CoinGecko podcast is produced each week to help you stay ahead of the curve. Show notes can be found at podcast.coingecko.com. I highly encourage you to join our newsletter where we send out top news in the crypto industry every Monday to Friday. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter and Telegram at CoinGecko. Welcome to the CoinGecko podcast. For today's episode, we have the honor of welcoming Benjamin Minku, CEO of Elron Blockchain. Benjamin is a tech entrepreneur and early blockchain investor. He was part of the NAM core team in 2014 and early investor in Binance, BAT, and Tezos. Understanding the inevitable performance problem the blockchain space was facing, he gathered one of the strongest teams in the space and began working on Elron to bring a 1,000x improvement in blockchain throughput, execution speed, and transaction costs. Elron recently went through the Binance launchpad and conducted its IEO, and we're very happy that Benjamin is able to join us for the podcast today. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Hello. Hello there. Really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I guess for the first question, can you explain to us a little bit in your simplest manner, what is Elron and why is it important?
Sure. So first, touching on what Elron is, I think one of the best metaphors to understanding Elron is looking at the early days of the internet. And the internet had basically two important inflection points that changed everything. The first one was the browser. And the browser opened up the web to the average Joe and allowed people to just point and click something, look over websites, and so increased the market significantly for the internet. And the second important inflection point was basically the transition from dial-up to broadband. So what Elron does is essentially the same of these two components. It basically first brings a transition from dial-up to broadband in the blockchain space, and then second also brings a user interface through which we will increase friction and simplify experience a lot. So what this actually means is that we are building a new blockchain from scratch, a layer one solution that brings a 1,000x improvement in throughput, execution speed, and transaction cost. And why this is important? Well, the internet essentially made the sum of all human knowledge available to all of us instantly through a device that was connected by it. And I think the same will happen with blockchain in the sense that blockchain will make the sum of all human resources available to everyone in the world. And more important, I believe and predict that probably during the next 10 years, we'll see that blockchain will probably become the most important GDP multiplier since the internet. So I'm extremely excited about what we are doing and think it will have a significant impact on the industry and future adoption.
Oh man, very big vision, a very big belief in blockchain technology that you just said being the main GDP multiplier. I was reading up a lot on Elron before this interview, and these two words keep coming up: adaptive state sharding technology and secure proof of stake, SPOS consensus. So those are some really big words. Maybe you want to break it down in simple terms. What do they mean and how it makes Elron special?
Sure. The idea is pretty simple, actually. When we started Elron, we thought, we saw the huge problem that the blockchain space was going to face that was already evident at that time. And this was especially throughput. So if your bandwidth, processing bandwidth is really low and you can process 5 to 7 transactions per second or 15 for that matter, you basically have no hope of global adoption. This is almost like a joke, right? But it still is very useful for you to have an idea that the technology works and so forth. But then, of course, you need to rebuild the technology so that you can accommodate internet scale performance if you really want adoption on the internet. So this is how we started. We had a very good overview on all the possible solutions that were available at that point. And also, we were aware of all the solutions that were attempted to be implemented. And so most of the solutions were really incremental and would only delay the problem. Say you would improve the throughput with maybe 3 to 5x, well, you're just delaying the problem, and 6 months down the road, you'll have the same problem if adoption really kicks in. So what we thought with Elrond was that if you can bring at least a 100x improvement in throughput, execution speed, and transaction cost, at that point, it makes sense for you to gather a lot more adoption because you can accommodate a lot more. So this is how we came to adaptive state sharding and secure proof of stake. What adaptive state sharding essentially means is that first you have sharding. The sharding part means that you basically parallelize transaction processing. So while in Ethereum or Bitcoin, you have this serial way of processing transactions where all machines process transactions, all transactions at the same time. In Elrond, you basically split, divide, and conquer. And this is a way through which you can come to an improvement of 1000x. It's extremely difficult to make this work, but if you can do that, this is the only way that will grant you a sufficiently high improvement so that you can really accommodate internet scale performance. And the second point is, so it's sharding, then state sharding, because there are obviously several versions of sharding. State sharding is the most difficult of them. But the whole point is, again, dividing and conquering things. And the adaptivity part means that if you build this network, you want to be able to run it with 2 shards, but then also with 100 shards. The idea is that the network should be able to adapt based on demand so that you are not constrained to launch with 100 shards from the beginning, which would essentially be very, very ineffective. So this is sharding, in 2 words, is parallelization of transactions. And the secure proof of stake part essentially means that if you can process transactions in parallel and have a much higher bandwidth, then the second thing you really require is a consensus mechanism that is really efficient, so you don't have proof of work and don't run into the same problems that proof of work runs into. Then second, it's really fast. Latency is low and you can have a much faster finality than in other consensus mechanisms. And then third and most important probably is it's very, very secure. And the security in secure proof of stake comes via random sampling of the consensus group. So this means that out of 500 validators number that you have in a shard, you basically have 61 validators that are chosen every 5 seconds randomly and then reshuffled every 5 seconds. And then at the end of each epoch that we define as a day in Elrond, you have another layer of security by which essentially 1/3 of nodes in each shard are randomly reshuffled to other shards. So to summarize this, the adaptive state sharding part means that you can parallelize transactions so that you can scale significantly. And the secure proof of stake part means that you can process these transactions really fast, really efficient, and really, really secure. So that by combining these 2 components, you have a working model for the internet scale blockchain. This is how we see Elrond at this point.
Yeah, that's really helpful explanation. Like, I mean, for longest period of time, a lot of the literature out there, and then like, I just keep getting lost on all these adaptive state sharding and secure proof of stake. I mean, but at least your explanation helps to clear a lot of things up. Next question is, who do you see as competitors for Elrond, and how do you see them stacking up against what you guys are building at Elrond?
I would go ahead and question the question here a bit. So the idea is for us, if you look at the technology and its adoption cycle, and also the most effective way you could use to bring the next wave of adoption, then you basically understand a few important points. First, when Bitcoin came along, although Bitcoin, you would say, would be normally understood by the guys in finance and banking, because it does have to do with this part, it was totally misunderstood. Bitcoin did not take off via bankers and finance guys. It had a really interesting niche of people, cyberpunks that believed in cryptography, that were very interestingly politically affiliated or unaffiliated, to be more precise. And then this was the group with which Bitcoin took off. But interestingly enough, when Ethereum came along, the interesting part is that Ethereum did not take off via Bitcoin maximalists. In fact, all the Bitcoin guys hated Ethereum a lot, and they still do at this point. But Ethereum found a niche where it had an interesting discussion with developers. It became relevant for developers, and then it took off. At this point, it seems to me that most of the architectures in the space are sort of playing the wrong game, meaning that today you will not be able to win if you try to play the Ethereum game. Ethereum already exists, already has a niche, already has a strong group of people with network effects and so forth. You will not displace Ethereum in its core group. So the only way to win is basically understanding and reframing the problem, understanding the problem extremely well. So what I think Ethereum has done well and Bitcoin has done well is that they have demonstrated that this technology can work and that its power is extremely, extremely effective if used right. But then what both of them have missed is they don't have the performance. The friction is extremely high whenever you try to interact with them, build on them, and so forth. So what we are trying to do with Elrond is exactly what I was saying at the beginning. Bring the same transition that we saw in the early days of the internet to the blockchain space. And this means that on the one hand, we bring a significant improvement in the performance part. And then on the other hand, we bring a very, very simple user interface that redefines how we use blockchain and makes it available to the average user without them even knowing. Because if you look at the early days of the internet did not take off because people loved the internet. The internet took off because it had one of the killer applications, like the browser, like email, and so forth, that slowly picked up a lot of adoption. And then as an effect, the internet moved forward with it. The same, I think, will happen to the blockchain space. There has been some wrong and misguided discussions have been in the space previously where Vitalik and maybe some other people just discussed about there not being a killer application for blockchain. But this, I think, is very flawed, a flawed way of seeing things, just because they were discussing that particular snapshot of time. So if your performance is really low, if the friction is really high, of course, you will not have a killer application. But this does not speak about the technology itself, right? When the technology works well enough, then you will have a killer application. And so for Elrond, I think we'll open up the door to the next wave of adoption by vertical integration. We are not building only the infrastructure layer, but we're also building a user interface that when you connect these two pieces, this creates a new game, a new space that we're basically the first to invent and take hold of?
So let's just say like Elrond will increase the blockchain capacity by 1000x, and then you guys will launch on mainnet soon and everything goes well. What do you think will be the, okay, I'm going to use the same word, killer application, or the first sort of applications that will be onboarded onto Elrond?
We've thought a lot about this and have also experimented with a lot of different directions. And for us, the most important thing in reasoning about the adoption part is not only where we see the highest or largest potential, but also how fast we can materialize this potential. Because it might be that the enterprise part is extremely large, but if it takes us 2 years to reach that point, because the sales cycles, the implementation cycles, the testing cycles are extremely long, extremely difficult, then we've also considered if there's maybe not a better option. And as such, we've discovered that basically, if you can build something that is consumer facing, you can move with adoption extremely fast if the application is useful, it's delightful, and much better than what people use at this point. So this is what we're focusing on. And so the first use cases we'll see in the form of payments, what payments really mean, and what money means. I believe during this period, especially, there's a crisis going on with respect to money, what money is, what it represents. And it seems to me that during the last decades, we've made some significant mistakes on this part by decoupling money from any, let's say, standard, gold standard and so forth. And now being able to print as much as possible with no accountability and no point of reference, right? At some point, this will become very, very problematic. You have to wonder when the music will stop, right? Because it seems like even during this crisis, there's a lot of debate and discussion about this. But yeah, to come back to your question, I see that payments and money are probably the most important things that we will have adoption during the next, let's say, 6 to 12 months. This is the thing we're putting all our focus on. We also have some interesting use cases that we are already explored and implemented with some companies. So we're moving toward that direction, but the primary focus is consumer facing.
So next question actually is about, actually I was supposed to ask this earlier, but I missed it out. How many shards are there or will there be on Elrond? You briefly mentioned between 2 to 100, and how would the state of shards sync with each other?
Sure. The idea here is that, as you mentioned, when you divide the state and divide information, there is indeed the need for a way to synchronize between all these shards. So how we do it in our case is we have a meta chain which has meta headers which always convey information to the shards and through which the shards convey information to the meta chain. And so this meta chain is the key component through which the shards can communicate among themselves and with the meta chain. And the meta header is basically the information, the way through which the shards and the meta chain communicate. There's also an important point that you mentioned where, although at some point we will likely need tens and hundreds of shards because there will be a really high demand in throughput, at first we want to make sure that we start with the minimum required, necessary. And from the beginning, we said that Elrond will set a new standard, meaning that we will do 10,000 transactions per second with the minimal latency and negligible cost. Now, we initially had 20 shards to do this 10,000 transactions per second. Then we improved things significantly in the testnet and came to 5 shards, which was a huge improvement to process the same 10,000 transactions per second. And now during the last 3 months, we've made some significant improvements again so that we can process more than 10,000 transactions per second with only 2 shards. So this is the minimum necessary. We will start the network at Genesis with 2 shards plus MetaChain, and each shard will have 500 nodes that will be present in that shard. So it will be 2 shards plus MetaChain and 1,500 nodes. This is the current setup. And I also outlined that while there are several other networks that claim to do sharding, they essentially don't do sharding, at least at this point. They either copy the whole information in each shard, but there's no cross-shard communication. Or when they start, there are some other networks which intend to start with 1 shard, which basically means you don't have sharding, right? But why start with 1 shard when you basically call yourself a state sharded architecture? But yeah, this being said, we're very excited by the progress we've made. It's extremely difficult at this point, right before the mainnet launch, but I think it will make a huge difference once we're live.
And you guys have your own native token, ERD, on the Elrond blockchain. So what's the economic or token model for ERD token? Like, how does it work? What's the use case?
Sure. So I will outline that everything you will be able to do in Elrond will require the ERD token. So if Elrond is indeed as powerful, as performant, and efficient as we built it to be, then the value of the Elrond token will be directly correlated with this type of performance that will be required by different companies, different applications, and so forth. Furthermore, there's the proof of stake part, which means that in order to scale the network, process the transaction, we require a number of nodes and validators that stake tokens in order for them to be able to process transactions and be part of the network. And then for their work, for the processing they're doing, they are basically rewarded. So the point is that at this point in time, some details are still a matter of discussion. We will very soon publish an economics paper detailing this. But what I can tell you is that we've made some very significant advances in the sense that when you're thinking about an economic model, there are 2 key ideas that you have in mind. The first one is bootstrapping. If you don't find a way for the network to take off and don't have a high enough incentive, then you'll basically be dead on arrival, right? There's no point on being sustainable longer term if you're dead from the beginning and nobody helps you bootstrap the network. So bootstrapping is the first important thing that you need to take care of. The second important thing you need to take care of is sustainability, indeed. And this means that once you've taken off and there is a strong incentive for people to come in and be part of the network and help process transactions and so forth, then you need to gradually normalize rewards and make it such that it still becomes, still is competitive, but it's not a point where you're like, say, Steam, where the inflation is so high that it breaks the model down. So what we've basically created is a model that in the first 3 years will have a 7.5% inflation. The second year, it will have a 6.25% inflation. And then starting with the 3rd year, there will be a 5% inflation. But the key point here is that we've already calculated what it would take for Elrond in the 1st year and every year afterwards to have 0 inflation. So we've created a model through which you can have the bootstrapping process at the beginning, but the network will trend toward a disinflationary model and then deflationary model, meaning that if you gather adoption, say you have 1,000 transactions per second in the 1st year, then you will have 0 inflation. At that point, the validators will receive 7.5% still rewards, but they will not come out of the inflation, but rather out of fees and real adoption. So I believe Elrond, in short, will be one of the first models not only to bring this type of performance, but which will show that you can bootstrap the network and then transition to a deflationary model via adoption in a sustainable way, which has not been done before, and which will be extremely interesting to see how it plays out and demonstrate in practice. What another point that I think would be very, very useful to be added and clarified is that validators will have 36% APR during the first period, especially the first year. And then delegators will also have something like 29%. So the idea is that everyone should be able to stake their tokens. And to do so, they will either be able to become validators or they will be able to delegate. If someone says, I have the tokens, but I don't want to run nodes, then they will have several options to be able to delegate tokens and still receive significant rewards out of them.
So this was fairly recent, right? You guys just started staking on Elrond, and then there's the node operator, and then there's the delegator, and then you mentioned briefly just now. So what's the minimum required to run a node on Elrond? And I think you mentioned 36% a return in the first year, followed by 28% after that. Like, maybe just tell a little bit more, and then how to stake and go on.
Sure. This is a very, very good question. So the idea is that since we will start the network with two shards plus MetaChain, we will have 1,500 nodes. And for this nodes, we will at first have a 2.5 million Elrond requirement so that you can run a node. This will only be during the very early bootstrapping process. But then afterwards, there will be an auction allowing people to put in a lot more Elrond per node and allowing them to still be part of the network, receive the rewards, and so forth. So the first phase, let's say the first 3 months, will have this 2.5 million Elrond required to run a node. And then for this, we've started with the rewards. Rewards will mean that you basically have 7.5% inflation that go to validators, to this 1,500 nodes. But then if you manage to exceed this through adoption and have an increase in fees that exceeds the inflation, then inflation becomes zero. So first, the fees will gradually decrease the inflation. And then when the inflation and the fees rewards are on par, at that point, you start to receive even more rewards through adoption. So to summarize, then you basically start with 1,500 nodes. There will be a 2.5 million Elrond requirement, and there will be a 36% APR that, at least for the first few months when you have a fixed number of nodes, will stay like that. And then after that point, things will basically become a lot more elastic, and we'll let the market decide how much things will change, but there is a predictable rate of rewards. And so adoption will probably kick in very fast.
So 36% APR, I'm trying to reconcile with what you said earlier about the 7.5% inflation. I'm not so sure how does 36% go into with the 7.5%. That's one. And the second question is a large APR sustainable for the long term?
Sure. So both questions, I think, are very relevant. The first one is, we have this inflation rate, which is out of the total circulating supply. For the first year, you have, say, 7.5%, right? And then this 7.5% divided by 1,500 nodes gives you a clear idea of what you will gain, right? And then you also have the variable of 2.5 million Elronds. But this basically gives you a clear idea of what you will gain. And this is how it's calculated. The second point is, if this kind of inflation or APR is sustainable. And to this, I want to just clarify that the Elrond direction is not very different to other directions that we have in the space. So it's basically a bit of a deviation from the standard, just because, as I've mentioned first, the highest priority is bootstrapping. If you've not managed to bootstrap the network, then all the other calculations are basically worth nothing. On the other hand, if you've managed to bootstrap the network, at that point, the other process kicks in of making it all sustainable and allowing the market to recalibrate everything so that the system works extremely well. It not only rewards the validators and people that are in the network, but then also allows them to gain a lot more while decreasing inflation to zero, which is, this is probably the most important thing about Elrond. It not only, as I said, not only brings the performance part and rewards the people and developers, but then it also does so by creating a hard version of money where the deflation, although it exists at the beginning, it very, very rapidly goes to zero as adoption kicks in. And you have a very similar model to what Bitcoin has, but much more robust in the sense that with adoption, you see specifically how inflation disappears or goes to zero.
Yeah. So yeah, the next question is, you guys recently did an IEO on Binance. You guys went through the Binance Launchpad and did an IEO on Binance. So just want to get some sort of your experience. How was it like going through the Binance Launchpad and launching an IEO? Like, how much did you guys raise? Like, how long did it take from your first conversation with the Binance team until you guys finally did the IEO on Binance? So yeah, I just want to hear your thoughts and your experience from it.
Sure. This is a very good question, although it's not done recently. So we've done the IEO last year. Basically, it's almost a year now, if you look at things. And this was a very, very interesting experience for us because it was exciting, very, very difficult, as you would expect, and then well worth it. And what I mean by this is, of course, the process was long. We had a lot of back and forth discussion, explanations, going through different things that we were building, the reasoning why we were building this. And then the most important part, which I always appreciated on Binance's part and their team, was the ferocity with which they push things forward, the speed and hardcore spirit of just building whatever needs to be built and finding solution to problems. And then while we were discussing with them, we've had calls at 2 a.m. in the morning, 3 a.m. in the morning, where we were during the day still in office, but then during the evening and night, again, in the office. And I think it was very difficult in the sense that we kept pushing ourselves as much as possible, trying to come up with new solution, faster solutions, and demonstrate what we were capable of. And at the end of the day, it was well worth it because they there was a fit between their hardcore spirit and our hardcore spirit. And it really paid off in the sense of exposure, right? Because we are building this architecture that is supposed to complement the open web. But if nobody hears about you, if you don't take off, as I've mentioned before, then you basically have many, many other problems to solve. Binance was a very efficient way, channel, of bringing Elrond to market, giving it a lot of exposure after we put a lot of work into it. We've raised 1.9 million first in the private round, and then through the Binance IEO, we've raised 3.25 million. And the experience was a memorable one and a fun one for the team. So we talk with a lot of excitement about it.
Yeah, it's good timing for doing IEO last year, because if you just delay 1 year, like now, like it's impossible. Like no one's doing any IEO, and I mean, raising $5 million plus, still pretty good. But like, if you did it 1 year earlier during the ICO, it would have been crazy times back then. But yeah, I'm glad to hear that you guys did a great IEO with Binance. I've heard a lot of good things with the Binance Launchpad, and everyone who say that who've gone through the Launchpad said the same thing. As you said, it's a 24/7 crypto market. It's not surprising that you have calls at 2-3 in the morning, you know. Yeah, but for my next question, right, I'm going to ask, like, what's the plan for Elrond in 2020 and beyond? I understand that you have some sort of mainnet that's coming soon this year, and there are a few phases to this mainnet bootstrap process. So maybe you can talk us through a little bit about that and some of the plans for this year and beyond.
Sure. The whole point of Elrond, as I've mentioned before, is to bring forth an internet scale blockchain so that once this is live, you will basically not worry about performance, you will not worry about friction, but can finally focus on building whatever you want to build, and it just works. We've been working on this for the last 2.5 years. It's a very, very difficult period at some time, some points in time, but then also an exciting period and a good period to reinvent ourselves. And we are now at the point where during the next couple of weeks, we'll basically have the Battle of Nodes competition run. And the Battle of Nodes competition essentially means that we've gone through several audits, internal and external independent audits. And at this point, we are preparing, in preparation for the mainnet launch, we'll go through a final trial by fire where we put the network out, we run things as we would in the mainnet launch, and then allow people to stress test the network, attack the network, and go through several scenarios that you have absolutely no way of testing beyond running them in the wild. And so as soon as the network withstands this test for 15 days without interruption, at that point, we know Elrond is robust enough to finally launch the mainnet, to have the Genesis launch, which is extremely exciting because up until this point, we've heard a lot about sharding, we've heard a lot about performance, but this has not been a theoretical problem. We've had the theoretical solution 2 years ago. We've published that, it's still live. This has been a very, very hard problem to build in practice because there are so many interdependencies and so forth, but now we basically have the whole architecture. We're just going to the final tweaks and processes where we validate that it's robust enough to really launch it, and then we'll have the Genesis launch. What will happen after the Genesis launch is we'll probably, during the next weeks, announce a lot of stuff, cool stuff that we've been building, experimenting with behind the scenes, and it's now time to bring it out. But then, as I've mentioned before, there's this user interface secret product that we've been working on that we'll also want to launch pretty soon. And the whole focus will be twofold. First, bring a lot of users in, and our target is to have 1 million users by the end of the year on this user interface, and then have a lot of discussions with developers and the companies we're already discussing with respect to the performance, the tooling, and the incentives that we have already built in. As you may know, in the economics part, we also have a built-in economic incentive for developers so that when someone builds a smart contract that is getting real adoption, they have a built-in business model because 30% of the fees that their smart contract will process will go directly to them, which I think is something very different and will put applications built in the blockchain space on a different trajectory, because this means that you will not have to create a new token necessarily. If you have a business model which is bringing you money based on adoption of the application you've built, at that point, you will just build applications for the sake of bringing adoption, bringing utility to the users, but not necessarily to create a token for each of these applications. So the Genesis part is right in front of us. A lot of excitement is building in the community for a few things that we'll share during the next couple of weeks. After the Genesis launch, there's also this secret user interface that we've built and are working hard on. A lot of energy and focus will be put into this because this will redefine the whole blockchain game. We'll make blockchain essentially invisible and bring the utility of blockchain to the user without them even knowing. And so this is the second point. And then the third point is we've had a lot of discussion with applications, with companies, and they can't wait to start testing and building on Elrond. So a lot of the focus will shift from building. Once we have things, it will shift into support mode on the architecture and then full focus on adoption. And for this, we have some very, very different approaches that we'll soon bring to market.
Sounds very interesting. I think you brought up a very interesting point about smart contracts getting a percentage of fees from the Elrond blockchain. I think that's not something that I've heard very often. I'm not so sure it's the first time I've heard it before, but I think it's certainly very interesting. So I think we reached the end of the podcast. One last question before you go. If someone's interested to learn more about Elrond, where is the best place to follow and learn more?
There are basically three places where you can follow Elrond. The first one is you can do it on Twitter, on the Elrond handle. You can go on elrond.com and subscribe to the newsletter. And then we also have several Telegram groups with a lot of excited community members that will guide you through. If you're technical, there's a technical group. If you're just business orientated, there's a general community group. And the community is actually growing very, very fast. And we very much appreciate any kind of feedback and support from people. So we'll be happy to have anyone in the community.
Cool. I'll include all these links in the show notes later. So if you're interested, you can take a look and join one of these community. So Benjamin, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the CoinGecko podcast and explaining to us what Elrond is and what the plans for the year ahead. It's very exciting hearing all your plans. So I just want to say thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was a great discussion. And yeah, I can't wait to see the mainnet out and then discuss some more once things are live and we see people coming to the blockchain with the next wave of adoption.
Thank you very much.
All right, that wraps up the show. Thank you for listening to the CoinGecko podcast with Bobby. If you like our show and want to know more, check out podcast.coingecko.com or please leave us a review on iTunes. If you have any feedback, do drop us an email at hello@coingecko.com. Join us for more next week. See ya!
This podcast is provided as part of the overall information on cryptocurrency contained on our website, is for your general information only, and does not howsoever constitute any endorsement, financial or investment advice, nor any solicitation or offer of securities or other financial instruments. CoinGecko and the podcast presenter makes no warranties, implied or express, of any kind in relation to this podcast, including, without limitation, the accuracy and updatedness of its content. All opinions and recommendations there in the podcast are based on the personal opinion of the presenter. Please conduct your own research and procure professional advice should you, at your own risk, decide to howsoever invest or trade in relation to the content contained in the podcast.